Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Summer's rolling in. Nothing better than the great outdoors. Some camping, canoeing, fishing, hiking, just a picnic. For many, that means state parks. For a special trip, national parks, especially now in tight times. But the country's great park system is under strain, and the budget acts, closing, scrimping, cutting corners. This hour on Point, summer in the great outdoors and our state and national parks. You can join the conversation. Are you planning to pack the tent? Have you seen the budget squeeze at your favorite state or national park? What's at stake here? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lots of news on state parks in particular. We'll look at both state and national parks. California permanently closing 70 of that state's 278 parks this fall. Ohio, the House there has passed a bill that would open up state parks and state-owned land to oil and gas drilling to help pay for park maintenance. Joining us now from Washington, D.C., Tom Kiernan. He's president of the National Parks Conservation Association, an independent organization that advocates for national parks. He was a senior official in the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Air and Radiation under George H.W. Bush and is former president of the Audubon Society of New Hampshire. Tom Kiernan, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Good to join you.
And with us from Raleigh, North Carolina, is Philip McNelly, Executive Director of the National Association for State Park Directors. He was the director of North Carolina State Parks for 15 years. Philip McNelly, thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here. Thank you.
Philip, let me come first to you, if I may, because some of the news on state parks is quite arresting. The majority of states, if I read this correctly at this point, are cutting back, some quite dramatically, on their state park budgets. What's the picture, Philip?
Well, the state budgets across the country in almost every state are under duress, and some states certainly are worse than others. California, Arizona, New York, Georgia are among the worst, but most states are feeling it to some degree.
Now, we saw this picture last week on page one here of a big chain and padlock across the gate at China Camp State Park in San Rafael, California. Closing, 70 closings, that must be the most dramatic step. But what kind of steps? What's the range of steps, Mr. McNelly, are states taking depending on the level of budget stress?
Well, a few states, believe it or not, are in reasonably good shape, but most states are experiencing some kind of cutbacks, and that can range from simply not being able to clean the restrooms as often as they normally would or not collecting the garbage as often as they might, to closing parks 1 or 2 days a week, to obviously the California example of closing 70 parks for the year.
What is it? What does this portend for the future here? We're in a tough economic spot right now. Everybody hopes for recovery, but recovery doesn't look imminent. I mean, what kind of what's the toll, I guess, in these years when park spending goes down so much? What toll does that take on the parks, Philip McNelly?
Well, generally, parks can handle budget reductions for a year or two. They can do it by reducing their one-time expenditures, like buying new vehicles or equipment or things like that. But as it goes on, you start to have an impact on the infrastructure, on the natural resources, on the educational programs that are offered to the public. And as the public experiences parks that are closed, you can even have an impact or will have an impact on the economic situation in the surrounding communities where folks normally buy groceries, buy gasoline, and eat out when they're visiting their parks.
What about the price of just getting into the park? We think our minds turn to parks in times like these when a lot of people are out of work or maybe working less than they'd like or, you know, carrying debt that's difficult. Parks seem like a place that might be a good option for a summer vacation in a time like that. What about entrance fees? What's happening there as states struggle a bit here?
Well, a number of states are being forced to increase all of their fees, the entrance fees, the camping fees, reservation fees, those kinds of things. But as you indicated, this is possibly the worst time ever to do that kind of thing when you have near-record unemployment, near-record home foreclosures. We have obesity and health issues. Our public needs the opportunity to get out to a relatively inexpensive opportunity to relieve some of that stress, whether it's taking a walk, riding a bike, paddling a canoe, and to be either increasing those fees or taking those opportunities away altogether, this is the worst possible time for that kind of a experience.
Tom Kiernan in Washington, you keep an eye on the national parks. Now, what's the situation there? Everybody, feels pride and love for those beautiful national parks and state parks, too, but the national parks are kind of iconic. What's the budget situation there? What's the upkeep situation? What's the access situation, Tom?
Well, the parks did recently take a small cut, not ideal, but we understand that, and I think the parks can manage for this summer. We're deeply concerned about some of the proposals for future cuts to the operating budget. Some have been looking, some members of Congress and others have been looking at, 7, 8, 10% cut, which would dramatically reduce the visitor experience in our national parks and cut back on some of the seasonal rangers and, frankly, hurt some of the economies that surround many of our beloved national parks. The national parks are a wonderful economic investment in addition to being great family vacations, but they generate $4 for every $1 spent at the park. So it's we should be investing in the parks right now, not looking at any further cuts to the park budgets.
But the federal budget, like state budgets, is under an awful lot of strain. There's very, very tough negotiations out there. We're sure to see more of that this summer. Could these cuts, 7, 8, 9, 10% be imminent? Are they being discussed as potentially part of a budget deal around the national debt ceiling, Tom?
We're hoping that the national parks are spared in that process. They, as I said, did previously, earlier this year, take a cut. What we're looking for is no further cuts. And we understand, we've been talking with both sides of the aisle in Congress, and we think there's some support. Frankly, now's the time as we're approaching the 100th anniversary of our national park system, and we are looking for less expensive, meaningful family vacations throughout the country. Now's the time to be investing in the parks, or at a minimum, keeping the parks with the budget that they have right now, so that we can have the seasonal rangers and the interpreters and the maintenance folks in our national parks. It was a number of years ago, frankly, where you would go into a national park and the only time you'd see a park ranger was at the entrance gate. We don't want to return to those days. And so we should keep the Park Service funding where it is or increase it a bit. It's a great investment for this country.
If you only see those rangers at the gate, I mean, the park is still there. The nature is there. What's lost when you have staff cutbacks in national parks?
Boy, the opportunity to hear from a park ranger, some of the most beloved federal employees are our national park rangers, to hear from a park ranger about the park. You go to Gettysburg or Antietam or Statue of Liberty or Yellowstone, it's the park ranger that tells the stories, that brings alive the national park, that explains why these places were and are so important to us. There's so many historic lessons to be learned. Here's just one example. Down at Fredericksburg, down in Fredericksburg, Virginia, the president called for just $250,000 increase in the funding for that park so that they can have 5,000 of the local kids come to the park. It's that type of investment that we're looking for so that the parks can teach us and inspire us about what it means to be an American. These parks tell the American story, and now's a time that we should be telling that story and feeling proud about being Americans.
I mean, I'm looking at the numbers here. In these years of economic hard times, campers, overnight campers in state parks, this is 09-10, so this is after the economic collapse, more than 52 million. That's a lot of Americans spending nights in state parks. And I'm looking at national parks here. Again, campers, I mean, RV visitors up and up, campers up every year since the economy went down. What about these national facilities and state facilities, Tom, in tough times?
Agreed. They are great family vacation destinations, camping in our national parks. I will say another example of the need for funding, the parks suffer under an $11 billion backlog of maintenance projects. So you go, unfortunately, to some parks and the bathrooms are not as, shall I say, modern as they should be. We need to be investing in the parks. Americans are flocking to our national parks. They're a great family destination, not too expensive. We need to be dealing with that backlog of maintenance projects. The parks also suffer under a $600 million annual funding shortfall. Many of the parks don't have all of the rangers that they should have, whether it's law enforcement rangers, interpretive folks. So again, it's a great experience, and it could be so much greater if we better funded the parks.
Philip, we're going to look at all the angles on this, plus, you know, the long-term picture for America's great park system. But what's your word to people considering this year heading out to state parks? Go and do it? Are the parks there, Philip, and ready, or like double-check because there may be a padlock when you get there?
For most states, the parks are there and ready. The directors, the rangers, the superintendents have done a wonderful job of trying to keep things open and operating. Obviously, in California, with the proposed closing of 70 parks, I think that is scheduled to begin in September. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, their summer experience may be open and available to them. Arizona is now down to 9 parks, I believe, that they are managing, but they have worked very hard and I think been successful in getting some local governments or nonprofit organizations to manage a number of the other parks. So, yes, and particularly in those states that are the hardest hit, they definitely need to check. But for the most part, the state parks are open and folks simply need to go on and enjoy that experience.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about summer and the great outdoors, state parks seeing some troubles, questions over our national parks, and we're looking at the future of our great park system in this country, especially important in tough economic times when people can use that, what we've come to think of as kind of right of Americans to get at modest cost into great natural settings and enjoy them. Tom Kiernan joins us from Washington, D.C. He's president of the National Parks Conservation Association. Philip McNelly joins us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, executive director of the National Association of State Park Directors, directed all of North Carolina's parks for 15 years, knows that scene very, very well. And Tom, Philip, lots of response online here. Deb says, I live in the Adirondack Park. I haven't heard about any specific cuts, but I'd be surprised if it remains unscathed in the era of slashing and gashing state budgets. Brenda writes here, I hit 2 national parks, Shenandoah and Great Smoky Mountains in April, the weekend before the threatened federal shutdown, and found myself throwing bills into the collection bins like crazy. I do hope these places aren't deprioritized too much, Brenda writes. Tom, what about Americans' attitudes toward the park? We've got really serious budget issues in this country. Has that chewed into American support for the parks and their mission?
Boy, Tom, that's a great question, and I love the spirit that Brenda was communicating with her message there. Americans love the national parks. We do a bit of polling to understand what Americans want for the future of the parks, and our national parks are beloved by all Americans. One of the encouraging points that I would make for Americans is, first, go visit the parks. Get inspired. Be educated. Spend time with your family and feel good about being American, and then get involved, whether that's making a financial contribution to the park or taking action, perhaps coming to NPCA's website, npca.org, from which you can send an email or a letter to Congress or help write a letter to the editor of your local newspaper. As Ken Burns' film told a year or so ago, the reason we have these national parks, and I imagine it's the same for the state parks, is that individual Americans stood up and said, we want this park created, we want it well-funded. So we need Americans to be contacting their member of Congress, and they can very much do that on our website, npca.org.
Here's a little clip from that Ken Burns documentary that got so much attention. He worked with Dayton Duncan to produce the film. And here's Duncan on the idea of the parks, the park idea, and how parks are meaningful for everyone, belong to everyone.
At the heart of the park idea is this notion that by virtue of being an American, whether your ancestors came over on the Mayflower or whether they just arrived, whether you're from a big city or from a rural setting, whether your daddy owns the factory or your mother is a maid, you are the owner of some of the best seafront property this nation's got.
there from the Ken Burns documentary. Philip McNeely, are you feeling that? For example, I know a lot of states and national parks are relying more on volunteers as money for staff gets short. Are you seeing people turn out to help, Philip?
Absolutely, both in the parks, but also politically. California last year was proposing closing more than the 70 parks that may be on the list this year, that are on the list this year. And it was folks like Elizabeth Goldstein and the California State Parks Foundation that came up with a method to keep them open for another year. And this year, while they're in trouble, it's the reductions or the closures are fewer than they were proposed a year ago. In Virginia, the Virginia Association for Parks and Johnny Finch responded to a governor's proposal to close five parks with such enthusiasm that by the time the General Assembly finished with their budget, they not only kept those parks open but actually increased their budget. So whether it's getting involved politically or actually helping with things like keeping the garbage cleaned up or sometimes the restrooms cleaned or the trails open, the public has jumped in, and the support is very strong.
Tom Kiernan, how far can that go? How far can volunteers take the kind of, the work of the parks? Can they take the place of an interpretive ranger?
They can absolutely help. We encourage more volunteerism and more philanthropy for the parks. But we have to remember that the funding for the national park system, the vast majority of it, is from Congress. So while we very much want more volunteers and more contributions to groups like ours and the National Park Foundation and all, I believe currently the philanthropic support for the parks is well less than 10% of the park budget. So point being, we need Congress to fully fund the national parks.
Let's go to our listeners. Ben's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Ben, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm a volunteer for the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, which is part of the National Park System in Omaha, Nebraska.
Good for you.
And I enjoy it very much, and I encourage other people to volunteer and become a VIP in the National Park System. My question is, even though there's less funding for the parks, it might reduce the impact on the parks, which is an environmental concern that I have. However, with less people visiting the parks, there's less enjoyment and fewer people get to see what beauty there is in this country.
Ben, are you saying there that doing your work with the Lewis and Clark Historic Trail, that you're kind of glad if there are fewer visitors because of fewer feet tromping on the lands?
Yeah, in a sense, exactly. I'm also a graduate of the National Outdoor Leadership School, which started the Leave No Trace program.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a less impact with fewer people visiting the park, which I'm conflicted on because I myself enjoy the park so much. I want other people to enjoy it also. But there is a lessening of the impact when fewer people are
coming in, yeah, but
treading, right,
but then that's just what people need, I think, very often these days, and it's supposed to belong to Americans. Tom Kiernan, what about this trade-off? We've had, jam-packed parks in a number of locations, growing attendance, and maybe especially since some of the economic downturn. How do you look at that trade-off? Maybe there's a little break for the parks if we don't have quite as much access. Or is that the wrong way of looking at it? How do you sustain support?
I would look at it a bit differently. I don't think it's a trade-off. I think as a nation, we can be smart about this. And we, with some great leadership from the Park Service staff, which we do have, and with good levels of funding, we can have more visitation to our national parks and keep them well protected. That visitation, maybe it comes in the summer, maybe it comes in the spring and fall on the shoulder seasons. But we are looking to increase visitation in the national parks and to better protect them. I think with appropriate levels of funding, and obviously not cutting the funding, but in fact making some strategic investments, we can achieve that. And that's frankly the vision and the mission of the national parks, to encourage visitation and to protect them for the enjoyment of future generations. That's the magic of our national park idea.
Philip, I wonder how widely people are going to have to reach here to support them. I mean, there's a lot of talk about privatizing elements of state parks in particular, about treating visitors as customers, not exactly citizen visitors, but customer visitors, marketing and all the rest. In Ohio, I mean, the legislature there passing law that would let them drill for oil and gas under the national parks. You see here Jack Shaner is with the Ohio Environmental Council responding to that, saying under park rules it is unlawful for a camper to tack a clothesline to a tree, but under this bill it would be okay for a driller to chop his way through the forest and set up a drilling rig. Is this where we're headed, Philip?
I certainly hope not for any of the parks. The parks are there for either the significant cultural resources or the outstanding natural resources that were the reasons they were created, and certainly to take those kinds of drastic steps to address what may be a short-term issue, I think is a huge mistake. I think in terms of Ben's comment from Nebraska, I would echo what Tom said and what you said about the need in the public, and my suggestion that the need is even greater now. When you have youngsters spending 7 hours in front of a TV screen, they need that opportunity to get out. And another issue that I would be concerned about is if California is closing a number of parks, those iconic parks that are still open may actually see increased visitation because opportunities are taken away from the public. So I think there are a number of issues that we really need to be careful, and hopefully the economic impact or the economic situation, it's certainly worse than we've seen in years. But at some point, would be our hope that the economy would improve and the draconian measures would not have been taken that can have a lasting impact on these parks.
And close some parks, and as you say, you're probably going to see more concentrated weight of activity on others. James in Fairhope, Alabama. James, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing today, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you know?
Well, I'm from South Alabama here, right on the coast of Alabama, and my dad works for Weeks Bay National Estuary Research Reserve.
Great.
Which is part of the state parks, funded through the state of Alabama. And we definitely, I've seen his reserve grow, and definitely tenants. Over the last 20 years, definitely has been up and up and up. And so really my question is what can I do? I'm 25 and I have a full-time job, but would still like to help, participate and help, ensure that these national parks are kept open. They've been a huge, part of my upbringing, and I want to make sure that the other people get to experience them the way that I have.
James, we hear that loud and clear. I mean, Tom, you're saying, volunteer, talk to your congressman. I guess those are the two big things people can do if they want to throw their shoulder to this wheel.
I think those are great places to start. I think also visiting the parks, James, getting out there and enjoying them just personally and getting that much more inspired, I would encourage that. And then back to contacting your member of Congress, let me just clearly say that matters. Having members of Congress hear from people throughout the country saying, we know you're struggling with a federal deficit. Yes, deal with that. There are a few places where we want you to fully fund, and those include the national parks and maybe one or two other things you might suggest. And again, npca.org is one place on our website where you can then send that member of Congress a letter or an email, and I think that makes a big difference.
The programs here in the parks, as you say, poll very high, maybe sometimes in terms of popularity or prioritization with the American public ahead of AIDS and cancer and lots of things. But I know that with this centennial coming up of the park system, there's been a lot of talk about the long future, about its second century. And Tom, Philip, maybe you've been privy to this, some of this concern that you've got a new demographics in this country and new waves of population that may not be as attached to the parks as has been the case. I mean, Tom, I know in some cases parks have come to be seen as kind of white middle class preserves and up, and not necessarily something that everybody's really interested in.
But Tom, I think the issue you're sharing is a big issue. We do have the 100th anniversary, the centennial of our National Park Service, just 5 short years away. And we are looking to have this 5-year window leading up to the centennial be a period at which we prepare our national parks for their second 100 years of service to the country and to the nation. We do think this is an opportunity where the parks and the Park Service can more effectively reach out to people of all walks of life, of all backgrounds here in the country, whether they be rural or urban or inner city youth. One of the things the administration is seriously looking at is having our national parks in great urban areas. Like up in New York City, we've got Gateway National Recreation Area, 26,000 acres right next to Manhattan. And there's an opportunity to invest in those parks so that kids that live in Manhattan or the Bronx or whatever can go to that national park and have a great outdoor experience, you know, 20 minutes, half hour from Manhattan. So we do see now is the time to introduce all Americans of all walks of life and all economic points to our national parks, and we're hoping the administration will lead on this effort as we enter this 5-year window leading up to the centennial.
We're going to talk more about that in a moment with Carolyn Finney in California. Let's get a call from Bob in Randolph, Massachusetts first. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for being on the call.
Yeah.
Hey, I second what a lot of people are saying. It's really volunteers are the solution to meet these needs. I work with a group called the Friends of the Blue Hills in Milton, Massachusetts.
Great.
We work on the Blue Hills Reservation.
Mm-hmm.
We work closely with DCR to brush the trails, pick up trash, and clean drainage structures.
So this is volunteers who get into the parklands and work to keep them in ship shape.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think there's so many unemployed people out there that I really think that they could be the solution. You come into the woods, you can learn a lot of new skills, and you really connect with the parks. A lot of the drainage structures were created during the Civilian Conservation Corps.
Yep.
My grandfather worked out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like I have a connection when I go out there and I work in the park. And I really just want to say that people need to get out there. By getting into the woods, you also build constituencies. And I think they definitely need to get in touch with their state representatives and so forth to get more money. DCR just does not have the money, and they need all the support we can get. But I think government's running out of money, and this is where the people really need to step up.
Hey, Bob, I really appreciate your call and your work in that vein. Philip McNally, what about it? We've got others online as well here saying, hey, we've got huge unemployment. You've got maintenance needs in the parks. Let's get people out there. Of course, it was done during the Great Depression, Civilian Conservation Corps. Is there talk of that? Anything like that again? Would you welcome that, Philip, or not?
Well, first of all, we would welcome that. Certainly, the CCC had a major impact on the parks. When I first started in North Carolina, virtually every structure we had was built by the CCC.
And from my childhood, I remember that, and they seemed just fantastic, sort of amazing, wonderful, rustic structures.
Absolutely. In fact, some of the new structures we're building are trying to mimic the architecture of the CCCs, both mm-hmm. in terms of materials and design. The work they did was wonderful and had a tremendous impact on all of the parks, national and state parks. And certainly, there have been a few programs, the civilian or the Youth Conservation Corps, AmeriCorps, and things like that have tried to take advantage. But I think Bob's point about the unemployed and offering them, some work to do and some ways to stay busy and do it in a constructive way is a tremendous opportunity that we need to look deeper into.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about summer and the great outdoors. State parks and national parks in particular, they are under pressure in a time of very tough budgets. And just at the time when people could use a low-cost way to get out in the woods, the streams, fishing, picnicking, you name it, camping. Tom Kiernan is with us, president of the National Parks Conservation Association. Philip McNally is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, executive director of the National Association of State Park Directors. Tom, Philip, lots of response here online. Jeff says, you know, we've got to... one of the things that separated this nation from any other when the national parks were developed is that our parks were just that, ours. He says he's got a political angle on this. He says the mindless mantra from Republicans about not raising taxes is going to kill everything that made our nation great. There's a perspective. I've got another here from Audrey, who says the dimensions of richness they've added to my life are indescribable. Having experienced so much of nature's majesty, simplicity, complexity, diversity, lets me think on a planetary level instead of just the more narrow personal level of what may be in my own interests. I think an ironic one here on the website says, sell them all. We need the energy, and only lazy people use parks anyway. Isn't that what a vacation house is for? Okay. And here's Teresa. She says, to ensure relevancy in an ever-changing and diversifying American public, what are the national parks and state parks doing to reach out and encourage diverse audiences to visit and participate in park programs and activities? Teresa, we are glad you asked. Joining us right now from Berkeley, California is Carolyn Finney, Assistant Professor of Environmental Sciences and Management at UC Berkeley. She was appointed by the Department of Interior to the National Park System Advisory Board. She's working on a book called Black Faces, White Spaces, African Americans and the Great Outdoors. Carolyn Finney, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me here.
It's great to have you. Tom and Philip are talking about the enormous support that the park system has in this country.
Yeah.
But there are indications that part of that is cultural and part of that is kind of white. And as this country rapidly diversifies and its demographics change, what do you see coming in public attitudes toward the parks, the national and state parks, Carolyn?
Well, you know, first I guess I want to say that the national and state parks aren't a discrete entity, you know, separate from the rest of American life, right? Mm-hmm. It's part of American life. And one of our biggest challenges in this country, in my opinion, is how we deal with the issue of difference. We talk about it as diversity, whether that difference be race, class, gender, so on and so forth, how we deal with that. And I think we're struggling all the time with how we deal with that. And so the parks are going to be affected by that as well. So when I think about, you asked the question about, like, where are we going? Mm-hmm. I think we're also still looking at where we've been. So when we go to the parks, and it's interesting because I understand that the focus on the parks is to go camping and to go hiking and to go kayaking, but I just want to underscore there's many, many, many reasons why you can go to the parks. I mean, I think Tom brought up the historic parks. Sometimes
sure.
Go to the parks just to hear a larger and more expansive story, to feel included, to be schooled in a way about our history. Sometimes we go because it's a social thing. We just want to gather with family and friends and maybe have a little something to eat and a good
sure.
conversation. There's a wide variety of reasons why people may want to go spend time in the parks, and I think that's one of the things that we have to expand to understand those kind of differences.
But your book is called Black Faces, White Spaces. Yes. You remind us that there are ethnic groups in this country, and some of them, you know, growing ethnic groups, that have not had such positive connections with the American wilderness or historical spaces.
Yes. So, you know, just to be transparent for your listeners, mm-hmm. you know, I am African American. Part of my reason for writing that book was really personal, was looking at my parents who cared for somebody else's land for 50 years and eventually had to leave that land, and really trying to understand how race, as one aspect of difference, informs how you think about the land, the environment, and in this case, the national parks. I mean, we have to understand, and for me, this is not disrespecting folks like President Roosevelt and John Muir, mm-hmm. who came up with the idea of founding the parks. I think it's an amazing idea. But at the same time that that was happening, there were Africans who were enslaved here in this country and who weren't allowed to own any land. There were American Indians who were being removed from the land. There were, later on in our history, Japanese Americans who were told that they had to be interned. You had Chinese Americans who were Chinese immigrants who were coming in and weren't allowed to move around and have the mobility as others. And the stories go on and on about many groups of people in this country who have a different history. I mean, mm-hmm. let me step back a little bit. It's all of our collective history.
Sure.
But, you know, what we consider important, what we prioritize in our life, the lens through which we understand our life is partially informed by our history. And so sometimes that can be a little painful. It's hard to think about the parks as simply a place where I can go to enjoy myself when perhaps I don't see myself in that story there. Perhaps there's pain connected to remembering how that land became a park in the first place and what does it have to do with me. And I just want to add here, that's also the richness of the parks.
Sure.
That the parks actually encompass these very difficult stories that tell us something about who we are as Americans and also tell us something about who we can be.
But let me ask you, you talk about hearing from black college students that
yes.
African Americans just don't go camping, and also that the concept of the parks as a spiritual place, the great
yes.
outdoors, works for a select and largely white, you've said, group of Americans. So that leaves us wondering, in this next century of the park's life, when minority demographics are, you know, growing very powerfully in this country, what to expect?
Well, I want to be careful and say that, you know, when you mentioned about black college students, I've talked to a number of African American individuals across the country
mm-hmm.
That come from various experiences. And one of the things that I want to, the issue of the parks, when the parks were created, they were partially created because we were developing an American identity. So the issue of identity is really strong.
Yes.
And when you have groups that define themselves by their racial and ethnic identity, part of that identity is expressed through practices, the things that they do. So when I would get responses like, black people don't do that, black people don't go camping, black people don't do, just fill in the blank.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Or you could use another group. It doesn't have to be African Americans,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, for
sure.
me, that's some insight into, you know, a group still working with constructing who they are. They don't want to be told who they are from the outside, but developing who they are. African Americans do everything, because I believe everybody does everything.
Yes, of course.
I mean, actually, all you got to do is look a little more closely at our history and see that. On the issue of spirituality, I think spirituality is an interesting thing because I think it's personal, you know, right? We're not saying religious, right, or religion. We're saying spirituality.
But it's also cultural. It is also in many dimensions cultural. When you talk about the spirituality
right.
in the great outdoors, that's not only an American idea, but it is especially or has been an American idea.
It's the way within which, you know, I feel that we come to connect to something larger than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our lives, we're in a country that really values individualism. And I think one of the things that we're learning is that you don't get through on your own. You need other people. There's something larger out there. How do we make that connection? And there's nothing like, I think, going to a space like a park. And you know what? It doesn't have to be Yosemite. Though Yosemite is magnificent. It can also be a small park down the street.
Sure.
A place where you can just take a moment to breathe and be with something larger than yourself and make that connection in whatever way that you feel comfortable doing so.
But do you think that notion of the great outdoors connected to spirit is going to be sustained in this country as the demographic profile of this country changes dramatically? Or is that something, you know, that was established by, I don't know, white settlers who saw themselves as victors and, you know, beneficiaries of moving into this land?
Okay, so, well, I would say that those white settlers, perhaps developed an idea of spirit. They defined it in a very particular way. But the beauty of change is everything changes,
mm-hmm.
including how we define spirit, including how we define wilderness. I mean, we can go on down the line. And whenever you have new people, you know, a change in our population, those definitions changes. I don't think spirit is ever going to go away. And
mm-hmm.
maybe I'm just expressing my own personal, you know, opinion about that. But I don't think spirit's ever going to go away simply because the population changes. I think about how that relationship manifests. It's particularly as we're talking to Park, that may change over time. And I think it's going to be our ability to see that, to support that, to engage with that, that is really going to make a difference about how we move forward in the future and how we become, and folks who know me know I don't really like to say inclusive, I like to say expansive, how we become more expansive.
I love it. Carolyn, stand by there in California. Tom, Karen, and Philip, what about this issue? How big a challenge is this, Tom? And what do you see? What do the numbers show currently? Let's first in national park usage.
Tom, this is a great question, and I love the work that Carolyn does. We've done some joint projects together. One of the strategies that we believe can help African Americans, Latino community, many others be enthusiastic about and increase their visitation in the parks is have park units be more inclusive or expansive, in Carolyn's point.
Park units meaning what does that mean, park units?
Additions to the park system. New
mm-hmm.
parks
uh-huh.
could and should be created that commemorate, celebrate, tell the story of from the African American community.
President Obama did this with the site where the ship blew up with so many African American sailors on board, as
exactly,
I recall.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Port Chicago.
Yes.
So that's one place. There are many, many other places throughout the country and, frankly, many existing parks that could improve and expand their interpretation to better tell the full story of some of these units so that the African American community, Latino community, can come to the parks and hear their story very much along with many of the other stories that are told in the parks. So we need to be expanding the national park system. We need to be adding units that are telling the full glorious story of America and what it means to be American.
That relate to those stories. Philip McNally, what have you observed in your many years in the parks about cultural differences in usage of the park and what they might portend for the future of our park system?
Well, I think there are a number of cultural differences, and I agree with many of the points Carolyn made. I do think maybe some of the educational programs could approach the differences in those cultures and help belie any discomfort folks may have. I certainly have seen people of all ethnic groups enjoying parks, and, mm-hmm. and some of those numbers are increasing. One of the things I would be concerned about is that this may be an economic or a demographic issue of folks, us becoming more and more of an urbanized community and all folks being disenfranchised from nature. And that's where I would go back to one of Tom's earlier points about the need to have the rangers or have very good volunteers who can relate to those different cultural groups and also relate the importance of nature and the historical focus of the different parks.
Let me get a couple more callers here, if I may. Jennifer in Seymour, Connecticut. Jennifer, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hello. How are you today?
Very well.
Great. Thank you so much for having this topic on today. The reason I called was I was fortunate enough that my father took us camping a lot in California to the national and state parks as a family. And it was wonderful. And my daughter, who is now 20, when she was 5, I took her on a cross-country trip via the train system because yep. I was by myself, couldn't drive, you know, the whole time. And it was the summer of parks. We went across this country from coast to coast and
wow.
went to a multitude of different state and national parks.
Lucky
and
you. Lucky you.
It was very lucky. I feel so fortunate that I'm blessed that I was able to do that with her. And to this day, she, you know, tomorrow she's off from her part-time job, and she said, hey, let's go to, you know, hiking tomorrow. Let's do something out, you know, at Sleeping Giant, which is a local park here in Connecticut. And I'm just so fortunate that she has taken on this stewardship of the parks, and she shares it with her friends. And it would be a travesty if something were to happen, you know, worse than what is happening now with the cutbacks.
Agreed, Jennifer, and I appreciate your call. I mean, when people see them and know them and are introduced to them, they're going to savor them probably for life, and I'm glad you've got that. Paul in Westport, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on.
Yes, I'd just like to address what was said earlier about volunteerism. I'm entirely for it, 100%, except we have to remember that things like rules and regulations for parks can't be enforced by volunteers, and I don't know that volunteers should be getting into that kind of situation anyway, where they're actually confronting people who might be doing something wrong in parks, because there are things in both state and national parks that are a little more
edgy, huh?
Than we care to think about.
Let me pick that up, if I may, Paul. Our time is so short here. Tom Kiernan, I mean, I'm looking here at Richard Just. He's the chief planner in the Idaho Department of Parks. And he's saying, you know, the idea that parks will be easily accessible and affordable and safeguarded by the state is at risk. I mean, there is that element of just keeping order and, you know, people feeling comfortable in the parks when budgets are under the gun. What do you say to that, Tom?
I think we need a combination of strategies. We need strong funding from whether it's Congress or state governments, and we need the volunteerism and philanthropy. Some people refer to the cake and the icing on the cake. We want both that underpinning funding from Congress or state governments, and we need the volunteers in philanthropy to have the full cake and icing. And it's the national parks and the state parks that tell the American story. These are beloved places. Now is the time to invest in them for our economies. And frankly, they are the soul of America. These are the places that tell our story. We need to invest in them.
Carolyn Finney, look out another century here. What do you think is the range of outcomes for our great park system in this country, depending on how we support them and how our own culture continues to relate to them?
Oh, you know, when someone asks me about outcomes, I always get a little nervous. So let me, what I would like to say is what I see as possibilities, you mm-hmm. know, the potential
yep.
for the future is that the parks for me, you know, I came to the parks late, I really late in my own life. I mean, my father, we never went to national parks as a kid, and my father told me that when he was a teenager and he grew up in rural Virginia, that when he saw a park ranger in a government, you know, in a uniform, he thought that would be a great government job. But he was told at that time in the 40s and 50s that they don't hire colored people.
Okay.
And now as his daughter, I sit on the National Parks Advisory Board, so I look at this, you know, generational change that has happened and the possibilities. So when I think about the parks, this is what I think of, the kind of change that can happen. It's, for me, it's not just about, you know, getting more people to visit the parks. It's about, you know, bringing science back into the parks. It's about education. What can the parks tell us about the changing weather that's going on out there? It's about, Philip, you mentioned this earlier, about health possibilities, the potential for people to use the parks as ways to improve their health. It's a place for people to connect to each other. This is about relationships. Parks are social places where we can come in contact with people we might not otherwise have come into contact with.
Carolyn Finney, we're out of time right there, but we're so grateful for you being with us today from Berkeley, author of the forthcoming Black Faces, White Spaces. Tom Kiernan at the National Parks Conservation Association and Philip McNelly with the National Association of State Park Directors. Please keep up the good work, and thank you so much to each of you for being with us today. Tom, Philip, thank you very much. Listeners, thanks for joining us. We'll go with little Aaron Copland thinking about the beauty of this country. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.